you know somebody who's just never satisfied? Well, my buddy Chris Phillips seems to fall into that category. He's one of those guys, those pesky fellows, who always thinks we can do things better than we're doing, especially when it comes to the way we govern ourselves. We've had him on the show a couple of times talking about his books, and now he's got a new project that we're going to talk about today. It's called The Declaration Project. We'll talk about it more in detail later, but suffice it to say that Chris wants you to get online. He wants you to join him and write your own declaration about, oh, something. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and it's all about the Declaration Project.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
From time to time, we poke fun on this show at people who mix up the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Even prominent politicians sometimes do that. And in fact, I think we had a PolitiFact check on exactly that issue in the not-too-distant past. But all kidding aside, the Declaration of Independence, even though it's not law, even though it's not the Constitution, is an extremely important document in not just American history, but in world history. That soaring rhetoric of Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, etc., etc. Those are important words, and they continue to ring down the centuries. Chris Phillips is a buddy of mine who thinks that that Declaration and many others throughout human history have been extremely important in setting an agenda, setting a high bar, of stating our aspirations, of guiding our future conduct. He's so impressed by the power of declarations that he has created an entire online project. It's called the DeclarationProject.org, DeclarationProject, one word, .org, where the Declaration of Independence and many other important similar documents are collected, as far as he knows, for the very first time. So you can go and peruse them all and see how they interrelate, see how they build upon each other, see how very influential our own declaration has been and how very important in world history it really is. But the Declaration Project is much more than that. Chris wants you to get online, and he wants you to write your own declaration. Why, you might ask? Well, that's because Chris is a rabble-rouser, as we've discussed many times on this show.
The Declaration Project was something that I hadn't planned to do, but turns out to make complete sense that it's something I should do. And it started when I held a dialogue, a Constitution Cafe dialogue at the Constitution Center. And I was asking folks what they would change in our existing Constitution if we could, and a precocious 12-year-old said, I don't think it matters if we keep it like it is or if we change anything, because nobody obeys it anyway. And she referred to the latest government shutdown debacle and said, look, they don't care about the Constitution. This was a 12-year-old. And she said, what we need is a new Declaration of Independence. We need to declare independence from the people who would effectively bring our democracy down. And that was just a stunning comment.
Okay, fess up, Chris. This is one of your daughters, wasn't it? Because she.
No.
This is a radical girl.
My daughter's. Well, she's not even 9 yet. She was at the Constitution Center. Maybe her rabble was roused.
I know what happened as soon as this 12-year-old girl spoke to you. You went over and tried to adopt her, because that's exactly your perspective, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I really need to adopt another rabble rouser in the family. That's what we need. But you know what? It also speaks to the fact, I think, that young people really care about what's happening in our country. If you look at one of the recent declarations, the most recent declarations that I've posted on our site at declarationproject.org, is from a guy who started collecting signatures for a declaration he wrote, a unanimous declaration of independence to break free from the use of fossil fuels. And so he gathered over 40,000 signatures, 12-year-old, and presented them to Congress. And there's a picture of him with this enormous declaration with all these signatures on our website. So it does speak to the fact that young people are quite often much more politically astute, much more in the line with our founders, much more sort of imbued with that spirit of 76 than most of us older folks would ever give them credit for. So it does show that you can sort of be radicalized in the best sense at a very young age. And so I started doing some declarational gumshoe work online, and I started coming across all sorts of declarations that I began compiling. And it turns out that throughout American history, whenever people have sort of seen that the path of our founders has gone crooked or astray, they typically issue a Declaration of Independence, modified, you know, adapted from our original, to make the broader populace aware of what's wrong and how we might write things. So that happened in the women's suffrage movement. They first issued a Declaration of Independence. During the civil rights movement, it happened. Workers' rights, it's happened again and again. So I think writing declarations is in our DNA. What stunned me was how many declarations have been issued in the generations since 1776 that have adapted ours and used it for their own purposes abroad. I didn't know that. Did you?
No, I did not. I knew that it had been the inspiration for many other declarations
or many other
documents, but I did not know that there were as many as there are out there, and they took such a wide variety of forms.
And such a wide variety of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Maori indigenous group in New Zealand, Venezuela, right, who were not very comfy bedfellows with.
Mm-hmm.
Ho Chi Minh began his Declaration of Independence quoting the first two parts, paragraphs from Thomas Jefferson, which I'm sure our government at the time absolutely adored. All of them have found that this declaration speaks to them and has sort of represented their own personal cry for freedom. Even if and as it's their notions of what that amounts to can vary quite dramatically.
Right. Now, you've collected a lot of these declarations, and you've put them at declarationproject.org. And in fact, that sort of is sort of the whole starting point of this, isn't it? I mean, that's the heart of your new website.
It is. It's just been this real serendipitous stumbling. I have been compiling them. I have about 50 more that I need to post, and I suspect that many more will come. Since I launched the site, I'm starting to get suggestions from folks who visited. I just got a suggestion from someone who pointed out to me that indigenous groups in Hawaii have issued a Declaration of Independence, and already I've found several different ones. So it's a wonderful thing.
We have high aspirations, and we have wonderful rhetoric, and then that inspires people, and then we have to work out exactly how we're going to live up to that. And that that often takes decades.
It often takes decades. It takes a certain amount of mordant honesty to look ourselves in the eye and ask us if we're really trying to follow the ethos and ideals of our founders. I mean, polls show that most Americans believe that our founders would be ashamed of what we've become, that we're not, that they would find unrecognizable the society that we've constructed, that it's not in any way fulfilling the vision that they had in mind. And so it is that maybe it's folks in other places who are trying to realize in their own time and climate and culture. I mean, look at one of the declarations I have on our site is from the Declaration of Independence written by Hilary Teague in Liberia when it became an autonomous nation. Hilary Teague was a former slave of the United States,
right,
who nonetheless was inspired by Jefferson's document. I'm sure he saw the absolute hypocrisy of a person writing about all men are created equal who had slaves, and yet he took the text in itself at its face value, and it spoke to him as he was writing the founding and liberating document for his own nation. And that's happened time and again.
Right. You've hit upon a really fascinating topic there, the entire creation of the nation of Liberia, which, as you say, was specifically created from ex-slaves in the United States. One of these days I'm going to do an entire episode on that subject because it's fascinating and tragic and hopeful all at the same time. So even ex-slaves, even people who had been enslaved and chained in the United States were inspired by our Declaration of Independence. That is remarkable.
Yes. I mean, on the flip sides, you know, Frederick Douglass on July 4th issued his own blistering letter about the Declaration of Independence, citing acts of genocide against Black Americans and how on our own turf that we were in no way, shape, or form realizing the ideals that were espoused. But once again, a letter like that, which we have on our site, is inflammatory, but it also incites us to maybe sort of rise to our higher angels and right the injustices. And I think that there has been sort of, you know, a slow, glacial, but nonetheless forward movement towards that. I mean, one of the declarations that we have on our site of independence was written by someone who adapted our original, calling for, you know, LGBT rights.
Mm-hmm.
That's up there. And look at what has happened, lo and behold. The latest Supreme Court ruling has made it clear that same-sex couples have the same rights to marry and divorce and all those things as anyone else. These things quite often, again, initially start, even if people don't realize it, from folks who go back to our original or so-called original July 4, 1776 document and adapt it for their own time and purpose.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy Chris Phillips, the author of The Constitution Cafe, all about his newest project, something called DeclarationProject.org. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Chris Phillips. So stick around. Turbo is written on the side of what looks like a really hot little Porsche.
They're Hot Wheels.
This is a big Hot Wheels. This is like three times the size of the Hot Wheels I played with. This is your car, isn't it?
Well, that's not the one I drove here.
It's not the one you drove, but it's the one.
Mark, do you think I could fit into that?
I don't think not. None of the three of us could fit into this car. It's about 5 inches long.
That is one of my toys from when I was a child.
Right, and so I'm saying this is a Hot Wheels car from which decade?
Oh, the 70s.
The 70s, really?
It's true.
Yeah, I knew you were almost as old as I am. No, this is just a bigger Hot Wheels, but it's a very nifty-looking little Porsche, and the door's open.
Oh, yeah.
The door's open.
My kids love that.
Exactly right. Okay, and that has something to do, I'm sure, with this quiz today.
Well, it's bigger than most cars because we're going to be talking about a Texas case that recently came before the Supreme Court.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this one, but before we do the quiz, we need to have a contestant. So is there someone on the line?
Yes, there is.
Tremendous. And what is your name, sir?
My name is Reese Brassler.
All right. Are you ready for a quiz, Reese?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, Doug?
All right, Reese, I'm going to ask you a question and give you four choices here. Are you ready?
I am ready.
The Supreme Court recently ruled on a freedom of speech case dealing with what on automobiles? Was it A, bumper stickers claiming the end of the world is upon us?
Mm.
B, furry stuffed animals blocking your view in the back window.
Mm.
C, state-issued license plates. Or D, spiked lug nuts resembling something out of a James Bond movie.
Goldfinger.
I'm going to go with C, state-issued license plates.
You went straight to C. You didn't want to talk about Goldfinger lug nuts.
Well,
you didn't want to talk about,
you know,
stuffed animals
or
the end of the world.
The furry animals is the one that had me thinking, honestly. But
that's speech, right?
Yeah,
if I put my furry panda bear in the back, right?
What now?
That's speech. If I put my furry panda bear back in my back window, I'm proclaiming to the world that I love furry panda bears.
This is true. I'm not sure how many people would be offended by the type of furry animal you put back there, but...
Okay.
Yeah, but maybe the question is whether the state can tell you you can't put a furry animal back there.
Oh, yeah. I think that would be the case. But that's not what Reese completely gravitated to. Reese, why are you gravitating toward a license plate so rapidly?
Well, it seems, one, to be the most reasonable, and two, I know about this case.
So. Oh, what case is it?
I don't know the exact name of the case. I know that there's somebody in Texas challenged. They wanted a state-issued license tag with the Confederate flag on it, and they said that it wasn't unconstitutional for the state to not allow that.
We have an expert on the phone, don't we, Doug?
We do.
That was the correct answer.
You got it. It is C, in fact. It is a state-issued license plate.
Yes, and it's got a great name. The case is a great name. Every time I see it, I think Walker, Texas Ranger.
I know, it's Walker v. Texas Division of the Sons of the Confederate.
Exactly right.
Veterans.
So what was the issue here, Doug?
The issue was that the Sons of the Confederate Veterans in Texas, they really wanted their own Confederate license plate. And the state of Texas said, no, we're not going to have a specialty plate. Now, it's interesting to note that there's over 350 specialty plates in Texas, including like Dr. Pepper has a plate, Mighty Fine Burgers has a plate.
Mighty Fine Burgers.
But the legislature in Texas said they chose not to have a Confederate States plate. And the Sons of the Confederate Veterans really called a question of that because they said that the state was, in fact, by not issuing these plates, they were blocking their speech.
Right. This is a fascinating topic and a fairly complex one, so I'll say right off the bat that we recently did an episode, and I think it was called Nazis, Confederates, and Government Speech, and it was all about the Walker case, and I had a really lengthy and really geeked out conversation with a good friend of mine, Doug McKechnie, who's really into this stuff, and it's a far more nuanced decision than one would think, and I'll simply try to summarize it this way. The question boils down to this. Whose speech is on that plate? Mm-hmm. Is that me, the driver, who goes out and buys a vanity plate, or is it the government that's speaking? And there's a concept called hybrid speech, where there's a combination of government and private speech. And the general rule is that private speech is protected by the First Amendment, but the government speech is not. Government speech is not an individual right. It's a power of government. And so it really boiled down to that. Is a court going to call this more government or is it going to call it more individual? And they came down and said it's more government speech.
It's government speech. Right. That's right.
And I think they made the point. You can put any bumper sticker you want on your car. But if you want to sort of enlist the government to in some sense, join your statement, whatever that statement is, by putting a Confederate flag on your car, the government has the option of either doing that or not. Mm-hmm. And that's the theory. Now, there's still troubling questions there. There's still troubling questions. Because that now the government's effectively in a position, at least in that little bit of real estate on your car, of saying, yes, this speech is okay. You know, the Mighty Burgers are okay.
Yep.
But the Confederate flag is not. And whenever the government's involved in saying this speech is okay and that speech is not, it's troubling, even if the First Amendment doesn't apply.
Yeah, it gets tricky. What Justice Breyer wrote in the majority opinion is, quote, just as Texas cannot force a private citizen to convey on his or her license plate a message with which he or she doesn't agree, so the Sons of Confederate Veterans cannot force Texas to convey on its license plate a message with which the state does not agree.
Yep.
And I think what you're pointing out is a good one, which is at what point does the state agree with one message over another?
Exactly. And the court was very clear on that. They're trying, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, at least a lot of people perceived that they were trying to legitimize their message by getting the state to go along with them. And the state simply said no. And the state has the power to do that. Wow. Fascinating case. Lots and lots of fallout from that one, I'm sure, in the future. Lots of states are going to be very happy because they make tons of money off of those. And if this case had gone the other way, if states had lost the ability to control the messages they put on their plates, a lot of states would have simply opted out because that's why we called the episode Nazis, Confederates, and Government Speech. Next week, it's the American Nazi Party. Next week, it's the Ku Klux Klan or some other objectionable group, and the states would then have a choice. Either we stop issuing these vanity plates or we let everybody put stuff on there.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Well, thank you very much, Reese. You got it. You got a T-shirt, so send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your T-shirt size. And we'll put one in the snail mail to you along with your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
That's awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, you bet, Stuart. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a delightful conversation with my buddy Chris Phillips all about his newest project, DeclarationProject.org. It's a website where he's collected things like the American Declaration of Independence and also other important similar declarations from around the world and throughout history. But, you know, with Chris, it's always about interactivity. It's always about dialogue. So there's another part of the website where he wants you to get down to work.
Declarations are important. I mean, these ideas bubble up. These ideas become current. And then political motion starts happening. At a certain point, somebody will say, wait a second, we got to sit down and collect our thoughts. You know, what are we doing here? What are our goals? What do we want to do? And you can call it a manifesto. You can call it a declaration. You can call it whatever you wish. But these documents are extremely important. Speaking of which, there's another section of your website with which I'm a little bit more intimately familiar. And this is the point at which I should put a bit of a disclaimer in. I sit on the advisory board of your organization, Democracy Cafe. But as one of the members of your advisory board, you specifically invited me to go to a section of the website called My Declaration. Could you talk a little bit about that, Chris?
Well, My Declaration is meant to be a space where people can share their own declaration of independence, of rights, of principles, or maybe some curious combination of all of those. Mm-hmm. You submitted one, I think, on Roosevelt's four essential human freedoms.
Well, in the email that you sent me about, you know, what are the sort of things that one might wish to write a declaration about, you mentioned freedom as a, you know, as a concept. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's a very interesting concept, but there are many, many different definitions of it. And as I thought about this, I couldn't think of any better declaration regarding freedom than the one that FDR gave in 1941 at his State of the Union address. That became the very famous Four Freedoms speech.
Yes, and it's very beautiful and eloquent and transcendent. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that you put that up there. The to pen your own declaration is a struggle.
It is.
My view is, and again, I think this is reflected once again in national surveys, is that on the one hand, Americans are furious that their elected officials do not heed their will. But on the other hand, they're honest enough to acknowledge that the elected officials are not the sole problem, that they themselves are also to blame, that they're not doing anything about it, that there's this pervasive apathy. And I argue that one of the reasons for this is they haven't really taken the time in the hurly-burly to just discover what their political voice is, and among an embarrassment of riches, what it is that they care most about and what they want to change. So My Declaration is meant to be sort of this cyberspace agora, you know, this place where people can take the time to struggle through their own notion of what it is that what their ideas and ideals for freedom and liberty are today, and maybe what they're willing to sort of sacrifice in order to achieve them.
You're trying to make us work, Chris. That's what you're saying.
It is. And let me tell you, I wrote my own, and it wasn't easy. It took me many, many drafts before I sort of could polish it enough and winnow it down to realize that what I cared most about was what I called rights for childkind. Kids, children and youth typically are marginalized from the public sphere. You know, they're considered purely citizens in the making rather than citizens made, and I argue that we're both at every age and stage. People get the heebie-jeebies when I write, as I did in my declaration, that we should lower the voting age to the lowest documented age in which a child enlisted in the American Revolution. I mean, if you look at the most iconic photo, the Spirit of 76, it look at one of the drummers in that iconic painting. He's marching through the thick of battle, and he's a kid, putting himself in harm's way. And let me tell you something, they didn't even have a means to defend themselves. They were just drumming, and they weren't just drumming for the sake of it or to keep the spirits of the troops up. They were drumming because drummers passed along signals to the troops about what types of movements they should be making, which could prove decisive in the course of battle.
Well, indeed, that's why they use not only the drums but the fifes, because fifes have those very high piercing notes that can be heard. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And so they were there. They were in the thick of things. It's documented that Andrew Jackson enlisted to fight in the Revolutionary War at the age of 13. Mm-hmm. So, again, if we can document that, Why in the world aren't they part of all men are created equal? Why don't they have the same political rights as their older counterparts? I believe me, I've heard it all in terms of, oh, they'll just vote like their parents want them to vote. Oh, they're too impressionable. I think they're less impressionable than adults. My experience is that they...
have you ever argued with a 13-year-old?
I have, and if I ever win one, I'm going to call you and let you know.
Now, you got a really good point here, and I think it brings up something else. Now, the argument that if you're old enough to serve in the military, you're old enough to vote, that was really what led to the passage of the 26th Amendment, lowering the national voting age to 18 during the Vietnam era. And, of course, any number is somewhat arbitrary. I think you make a case that, if you've been old enough to serve, that perhaps you should have some say in the body politic.
Yeah.
And I think that there's another more current example of that, where there's a great generational divide on a very important issue, and that's the issue of global warming, climate change. If you speak to people, you will find that typically people who are old codgers like you and I tend to be the primary place where you'll find the deniers, or people who, even if they acknowledge the science, are going to want to put off doing anything of particular significance because they either don't want to attribute it to human activity or they think it's too expensive to address. And on the other hand, you talk to anybody under the age of 30, and certainly people in the teenage years, which is what you're talking about, and they are on board. They want to get this problem fixed because they're the people who have the greatest time left on the planet, and they want a planet that's going to be habitable. So just talk to a young person about climate science, and you're going to get an earful.
Yes, and I think that's reflected in that declaration I was talking about that we have on our declarationproject.org site.
Mm-hmm.
Young people care deeply. Now, there's not just a disconnect between the young and the old, but there's a disconnect between ordinary American citizens who and what the pulse of the nation is and our elected officials. I mean, studies show from the Pew Trust that at the very few occasions when our congressmen do actually come together enough to pass a law that's actually signed by the president, that it typically does not represent the will of the people. But one example is the pervasive concern across the board, across the political spectrum, for radical overhaul of the way campaigns are financed. I mean, Republicans, libertarians, progressives, liberals, they all are dismayed by the way that a billionaire can try to buy an election, or the way that PACs can completely steer the outcome of an election. But our elected officials honestly don't care. Yes, those running for office may pay lip service to it, but you darn well better know that once they're in office, they'll forget about the whole thing. This is something Americans care about deeply. I'm actually surprised that so far nobody has posted a declaration that has to do with the crying need, according to the American public, for campaign finance reform.
Well, I'm sure that'll happen in the very near future. And speaking more generally about the My Declaration aspect of it, as someone who has posted one, and even though I cheated and largely quoted from someone else rather than drafting it myself, even that relatively limited participation on my part did prompt a lot of thinking.
And I'm sure it did.
Yeah, sure it did. And that was it took effort, took time. You had been asking me for several weeks to do it, and I kept putting it off because, of course, everyone's busy.
Yes. But when have you noticed I'm a little pushy?
Yes, you're extremely pushy and irritating, but that's okay because people who get things done are typically that way.
Well,
that?
My heart's in the right place.
Well, that remains to be seen. I don't know, but certainly you are definitely pushy.
Now, you said that Roosevelt's cry for freedom, his, mm-hmm. his four kinds of freedom, mm-hmm. from want, freedom from fear, freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, and freedom of speech and expression. Mm-hmm. Is a definite basis, and this is quoting you, a definite basis for a kind of world. No, you said, I firmly believe that these four freedoms will be secured everywhere in the world. And you preceded that by saying, we're still working on it, Mr. President. So that, to me, resonates.
It does.
That one sentence is like, you know, this is a guy who cares deeply about this, and he reached back into time to find this very transcendent statement by Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And I dare say that people, you know, this is an interactive site. On all three sections of our site, including the Spirit of 76 component that we haven't talked about yet, which is Socratic exploration of these themes from the declarations, whether it's self-determination, liberty, equality, independence. It invites people to react and respond to these declarations, whether they're posted on my declaration or whether they're in the declaration collection. Mm-hmm. I dare say that many of the declarations to come that will be posted in my declaration will spring from people reading my declarations like yours, as well as some of those in the declaration collection.
Yep, and responding to them and having civil debate on them is always a good idea, and thought, of course, should precede action. But ultimately, of course, you want people to take action. You want them, after they've thought about it and carefully considered differing viewpoints, to go out and get involved and provide the sort of political participation that means that our elected officials will actually listen to people rather than just to campaign contributors.
Well, I'm a firm believer in the extraordinary wisdom of ordinary people. Jefferson was too. That's a Jeffersonian idea. I'm hoping that the Declaration Project will be one among many efforts right now to create a groundswell among people to realize sort of an epiphany that change begins with them. And often that foundational change begins with discovering what you care about most deeply and what you're willing to put on the line to bring about that kind of change, whether we're 12 years old or, you know, in mid-50s like yours truly. If we really care about the course of our country and the ramifications of our own actions and how they impact people on the other side of the globe, people we may never meet, I think it behooves us to kind of tap into our revolutionary heritage and sort of look ourselves in the mirror, so to speak, and figure out what it is that we have to do right here and now that would make our founders proud. They believe that we shouldn't rest on their laurels, that we can be better than they were, but take action today. So, and we even have a take action site. I'm hoping that people, after they post their declarations and read our collection, will be inspired to take action. Ultimately, that's what it's all about. We have some links to partners on our site, but I'm hoping that many who post their own declarations will come up with their own idea if they don't see something out there that has already been started, where they'll become the latest civic and social entrepreneurs, and that we'll then share it on our site.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the middle of a delightful conversation with my buddy Chris Phillips, the author of Constitution Cafe, Socrates Cafe, you name it, he's written it. And it always seems to have something to do with cafes. That's because Chris likes to talk, and he wants you to join him in a new discussion on his new website, declarationproject.org. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Chris, and then we'll have a special treat. I just got back from Montpelier, so stick around.
Seems to me.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and in just a little while, we're going to have a visit back to Montpelier. You know where that is, James Madison's historic home, where I recently had the pleasure of doing some stuff I haven't done in a while. But first, let's finish our conversation with Chris Phillips, all about his newest project, declarationproject.org.
Well, I'm looking at declarationproject.org as we speak, and I notice there are some other tags as well, including one that says, please donate. And I'll put in a plug for that because, of course, this is all nonprofit and it all costs money. And so if people believe in what you're doing, Chris, they're certainly welcome to pony up a few dollars as well.
That would be wonderful. I mean, I've been working full time plus of this. You have to understand something about me. I don't wait for funding to do something.
Yeah, you're pushy.
Yeah, if I need to do something, if I think it needs to be done, then I just do it. That's how I launched Socrates Cafe nearly 20 years ago. It wasn't about, well, Chris has first got to get us X amount of funding. No, it just like I realized in our polarized time that there was a crying need to recapture and resuscitate types of discourse that existed way back when in the Athens of old. The same thing, I mean, and this is the first project where I've really depended on the kindness of friends and strangers to help me. Mm-hmm. I could not have done this site without this, our youngest board member, who has developed the site on her own with no funding of any sort. She just took it upon herself because my idea spoke to her.
Well, what is this young lady's name?
Her name is Danielle Olson.
Well, kudos to Danielle.
And she has been extraordinary. It's been a beautiful thing to see how this project has resonated with so many in our board and our advisory board, to the point where they would devote their time and their talents to helping me develop this.
Right.
I have high hopes for this project, Stuart. I think that everything, you know, you said that thought precedes action, or at least it should. I think that it's time for people to once again take the time to discover what their political voice is. And I think once they do, it will be almost irresistible for them to take action in a way that I believe over time Americans of very vast and diverse political dispositions will nonetheless be galvanized to take some forms of unified action so that their voices can be heeded and heard. Mm-hmm. So in other words, to create a system in which they can get in the mix. And
right.
So one view will win the day now, and another view will win the day maybe down the road. But at the very least, where they finally can have a real impact in the way that things are.
Right. Well, you've been rousing the rabble for a long time. And in fact, we've mentioned a couple of your book titles, but I'll mention them again. I believe the first was Socrates Cafe, followed by Constitution Cafe, all of them out there that sold very well, and people can find those titles online. I'm sure they can get them on Amazon or perhaps at their local bookstore. And all of them are trying to engender this sort of Socratic dialogue, this sort of self-awareness discussion between people, whether it's about democracy or about more general subjects, as in the Socrates Cafe book. But those are all still available. They're still all in print, and it's another way to support your efforts is for people to go out and send a few dollars your way.
Cha-ching. Well, you know, sir, speaking of Socrates, you know, he was sort of the last democratic man standing at a time when society was closing up.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often it takes a lone wolf who cares deeply about his country and is willing to put it completely on the line. Look at what happened to Socrates.
Well, I was about to say that, Chris. Yeah. You know what they did to him.
Yes, but
so,
I mean, look at
this.
Look
this
at
could
what
all end very badly
yes,
for you.
But it could have ended badly for those signers of our Declaration. I mean, and it did end badly for some of them. Some of their lives were absolutely ruined, but nonetheless, the idea of breaking ties with Britain and the possibility, just the mere possibility of bringing about a better day for a constitutional republic of a democratic bent was enough for them, in many cases quite wealthy, affluent individuals, to risk it all for the possibility of greater freedoms. And that speaks to me, man. That speaks to me. So when I wrote that declaration of mine, I, as corny as it sounds, I really felt that spirit of 76 welling within. I think it's in our DNA. I think that we are America the Declarational. And it's time for us to allow that to spirit to kind of permeate us again, and so it's an irresistible force. I think once we become this kind of force to be reckoned with, there's no stopping us.
Well, in support of what you've just said about your commitment, I recall the famous last line of our Declaration of Independence. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That was quite a pledge.
Amen. And they were not mere words. They put it on the line. Say what you will about whether they reflected the sensibilities of everyone, but those words spoke to them in such a way that they really were willing to risk it all.
Well, I guess if they could risk it all, we can risk a little bit by composing our own declarations, talking about them, thinking about them, and ultimately taking appropriate action. So Chris Phillips of DeclarationProject.org, thanks so very much for sharing your latest effort with us.
Thank you, my friend.
Now let's head over to the Virginia Piedmont, out to Montpelier, where we're going to see what's going on there, because there have been some major, major things going on at Montpelier over the last year. Perhaps the most notable of them in terms of finances is a $10 million gift from a fellow named David Rubenstein. Yep, you heard me right, $10 million. And much of that money is being spent on the slave cabins.
My name is Stephanie Hallinan. I am the new public archaeology technician here at James Madison's Montpelier.
So you work with Matt Reeves?
I do, yes.
Tremendous.
He's my boss.
Oh, well, he's a nice boss,
yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, he's great. He's wonderful. I actually just started. I've been working here for about a month now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do here is I was hired to interpret the archaeological project that we're working on to the public. So I work Wednesday through Sundays. So we're not digging on the weekends, but I'm here to at least tell people
this
what's
is, this
going
is an active
on.
Dig. This is this on the
is
South
active.
Yard, right?
Yes.
So what are you digging for here in the South Yard?
So there were six structures located here that we know about from an 1837 insurance map. And this is where the enslaved domestic community would have been living and working.
So these are the house slaves?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is, so what we are doing is we are actually searching for where these structures were located and to trying to figure out what they were made out of so we can start rebuilding them.
Right. And that's all being done with that $10 million Rubenstein
grant,
right?
It is, absolutely, yeah. Yep. So that is, the excavations, the interpretation, the reconstruction, and also finishing, refurbishing the home,
right,
is all being done with that money. So we're
thank
very,
you, Rudenstein.
Very grateful.
You.
Very grateful. So this project it's been wonderful. We've already found two of the slave quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to start rebuilding those in July. Right now in the summer, we're...
And when you say rebuilding, you're not talking about just framing them out the
no.
way they've been in the past. Those
no.
are sort of ghost structures.
Exactly.
This is going to be a real reconstruction.
Yeah, we're actually going to rebuild. So the two duplexes we found had, one had a brick chimney base
mm-hmm.
with brick footings. The other one had a stone chimney base with stone footings. We're actually going to be putting those foundations in. And then they would have been timber frame structures with glazed window glass. So we're actually going to be putting those back how they would have looked.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And how do you get a cool job like this?
You get lucky. Luckily, they were hiring for, this is a brand new position, actually, my position is.
Right.
This is being done through with the Rubenstein money. So once again, yes, very good, very thankful,
well, thank,
very
oh,
grateful.
Absolutely, thank you again for
absolutely.
That. Exactly, but then because you're the newbie,
mm-hmm.
you have to stand out here in 90-degree heat on
yep.
a humid day and explain to people like me what all this mess is. So what is all this mess right here? I mean, what are we actually looking at when we look out here over this tarpaulin and this hole?
So this is actually the active area now. So we've already finished up over there.
Right.
Now we're working kind of in the center area where we see, which a lot of it is covered over. It needs to stay protected with the heat.
Mm-hmm.
Now
I saw you hosing down an area there.
Yep.
Was that just to keep the dust down?
It's basically the sun is so hot here and it has so much clay in the soil that
mm-hmm.
things bake out very easily.
Ah.
So that's why we really need to keep things covered, or if we have them open, keep them hosed down. So I have to hose it down every half hour or so,
wow.
to protect it. Because once, if we go back and start excavating over there later on, we won't be able to get a shovel or a trowel in if the sun is just constantly baking it out. Everything will just start to crumble. So
oh,
we really
okay.
have to be careful. So when we're actually digging, we actually have two large tents set up during
mm-hmm.
In the heat of the day, which is great for us because it protects us, but it also protects the site that we're working on. We also have easy pop-up tents that we use
mm-hmm.
So that we can move them around easily. where, depending on where we're working. And at the end of every day, we cover everything over with tarps to protect it from the sun and to protect it from any rain. And we sandbag everything down. We're supposed to have some brutal storms tonight. So I'll have to make sure that I pack it up real nice and
tight. I see the big sandbags.
Tonight.
Yeah, that'll be very helpful to you.
Exactly.
Now tell me, what is the coolest thing you found here?
You know, we've been finding so many things that would have belonged to the enslaved community, but a lot of it has been we've been finding a lot of hand-painted ceramics that we know are different items that are being used in the main house. So
they're not the main house ceramics.
Exactly. So
these
we
are the
know,
slave ceramics you're
yes.
thinking. Okay.
So these are actually the people that were living here. This is showing that they're actually purchasing and going on picking out objects for their own personal use. Mm-hmm. So it's really great to find items like that where we can actually see the people, their agency through the objects that were left behind here.
Very, very cool. Well, I have to say, as I've said to Matt many, many times, is that I'm very, very proud of the way Montpelier faces up to the slave legacy, very front and center.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is right next to the mansion. I mean, we're, 50 yards at the most?
Yeah.
From the south side of the house, and
yeah.
it's right here, and you're talking to everybody who comes by. So this is we're not soft soaping this. We're not
no.
Soft, you
know? And I don't know if you're aware of this, but just recently we had some of the descendants from the enslaved community.
Yes, I saw
were
that.
Here,
I wish I could have been here that
yeah,
day.
Yeah, I wasn't here myself, but I heard that it was a wonderful experience. They were actually here working with us for a week, because we have a lot of public programs where the general public can come. We have housing available on the property, so they can come and work with us. So they can work on the site with us here, excavating, or they can work in our lab or doing metal detecting. We do have all kinds of programs to really get the community engaged. And having that descendant community here recently was it was just an amazing experience, and we learned so much from it, and they were able to also participate in their own history.
This is like going back to the old family homestead.
Basically,
this was their
and
home.
It's, you know, it's really yeah. So we're trying to open it up to all people. So we have people come from all over the country to come work with us.
Tremendous. Also, people can actually help with the excavation too.
Absolutely.
How do they do that? If I wanted to be part of the excavation crew, if I actually could tolerate being out in this country and working. How would I do it?
So there we have a website www.montpelier.org/expeditions.
Right.
So you can sign up for those, and actually we teach you. So it's a week long program, and you work directly with our staff members, because we have about 10 full-time staff members working here. So you work side by side our staff members to learn all the methods and the processes of archaeology.
So if a young person was thinking that he or she might like to be an archaeologist, this sounds to me like a great opportunity
yeah,
to kind of learn how it's actually
absolutely.
Done.
Absolutely, and in all ages. I think our age range currently is we've had people from ages 10 to 83. We also do field schools through we do one field school through James Madison University, and another one.
You mean
through,
you go out someplace else is what you're
they
saying?
They actually, no, actually,
well,
the students can come here and live and work with us for 4 weeks and get college credit through James Madison University. We do two a summer, so we do one through JMU, and then we do another one through SUNY Plattsburgh, which is located in upstate New York.
Tremendous. So
yeah.
Montpelier.org, click on the appropriate archaeology links, and then
uh-huh.
they can figure out how
and
to do all this.
There's all community programs, and the expeditions is where you can get more information, or we have a field school link as well.
Well, Stephanie Hallinan,
excuse
me, the brand new archaeologist at Montpelier. Thanks so very much for sharing this with
thank
us.
Thank you. Thanks for stopping by. I appreciate it.
After we finished with Stephanie in the slave cabin outside, we decided, and I say we, that was my son Ben and his friends Ellen and Andrew, who came with me to Montpelier that day, we decided to take a house tour. It'd been a long time since I'd been in there, and in fact, this is my first tour since the old library was refurbished. Now, if you're a Madison scholar or a regular listener, the two are sort of the same. You'll know just how very excited I was to see the old library, because this is the Constitutional Holy of Holies. This is where Madison went for months before the Constitutional Convention and figured out his Virginia plan. This is where it all began.
This room is set to a different period than the rest of the house. Most of the house is set to the Madison retirement era, so 1817 on. But during the retirement era, this room is used as storage. You could not see one door from the other. There's just so much stuff in here, and I personally don't know what that was. I'm guessing there are at least some books from those 4,000 volumes that Madison had, but also maybe the odd bit of furniture and some of those papers that he would have been receiving. This room, though, is set to 1786, the winter before the Constitutional Convention. Madison came here, back to Montpelier, and holed himself up in this room and essentially just prepped for 6 months, preparing for this Constitutional Convention. Before the convention, the government that we had in place was the Articles of Confederation. This was a very weak form of government, and Madison knew that this essentially needed to be scrapped. It needed to be gotten rid of, so he was up here starting new. In the 18th century, it was generally thought that for a republic to be successful, it needed to be very small and very homogenous. People needed to have similar values, working towards a similar goal. But when you have a small homogenous society, it's very easy for one faction to take over. So Madison's solution to this, which is really his unique contribution, was to essentially have more people, more land, more ideas, more diversity, and more factions. So the more factions you have, the less likely it is that one will be able to take over and gain power. Another addition to his notes was branches of government. That's not really a new concept, but he again sees the value in this because it allows things to be slowed down and also helps prevent one faction from taking over. So he's up here, he's working, he has all of these notes together, and he arrives to the convention 11 days early. The other Virginia delegates, they all arrive early as well. They come up with the 15-point Virginia plan, and this is what is presented at the convention and what eventually will become the Constitution through debates, discussion, compromise, so on and so forth. September 17th, 1787, the Constitution was ratified by the convention, and it then went out to the states, to the people. Madison, along with Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, wrote the Federalist Papers to educate the people about the Constitution, presenting arguments for the Constitution. First three words of the Constitution are, "We the people." So Madison, when he was up here working, he saw the value of having the people as the backbone of this government's power. The Constitution was ratified by the Ninth State on June 21st, 1788, New Hampshire. So since that date, it has been our form of government. It's been our constitution, so over 200 years. Globally, the average lifespan of the constitution of a constitution is only 17 years. So Madison, when he was up here working, he had a very good idea of what he was doing, had a good grasp of how this might work out. So when you're thinking about legacies, Madison's legacy, today it's us. It's our responsibility to be those active and engaged citizens that Madison was seeing when he was up here working, prepping for this convention. So thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you. Ooh, I just got chills there. How about you? Thanks so much to tour guide Lauren, who did such a tremendous job. Now, here's just a little more snippet of our reactions, Ben's and mine's and Andrew's, to going to the old library.
Well, here we are. We are in what I like to call the womb of the Constitution. This is where it was conceived. We're in the Holy of Holies. We're in the second floor library at Madison.
It's a weird thing to say, Dad.
No, it's not a weird thing to say. That's how I always think of this place. This is really this is where it all began. And we're looking out at the Blue Ridge, and there's a desk here. You can just imagine James Madison sitting here, can't you?
I think the story of James Madison is really the story of a guy who just did his homework better than everybody else. And so they all came.
Thank you, Andrew. Yes, it does. At least in this representation, this desk, there's a protractor on it. But I mean, seriously, you could sit in this chair and you could just look up under the eaves, and there's the Blue Ridge in the distance. What an inspiring view! And as the tour guide has pointed out, that was the Western frontier. So he was literally looking at the future of the United States, geographically speaking.
Thank you for coming.
I mean, it's a perfect setting.
Well, you know, he's looking at the future of the United States, politically speaking, if you looked at his desk, so yeah.
I suppose that's true. Okay. Ellen, what do you think about this? Ellen doesn't like to talk, but that's okay. I could stand here all day, but Lauren, the friendly tour guide, wants us to leave now, so we must make room for the next group. They've got a right to be here, too.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Chris Phillips for telling us about declarationproject.org. Get online now. Check it out. It's a great site. Thanks also to Ben and Andrew and Ellen, who went with me to the old library, who went with me on that tour of Montpelier. Thanks so much to Lauren, and thanks so much to Stephanie for sharing their experiences with us. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.